All right, we are definitely plugged in now. So you're listening to the Kraz Files podcast with Adam, and it's Wednesday night, the 11th of March here in Sydney, Australia, 2020. So I don't need to tell our listeners that time is absolutely flying by. But everything's up on my website, krazfiles.com, as usual. So much going up, so please check that out. Everything's connected over there as well. So a lot of work over the years to make it like that. So you can contact me through there as well anytime you want about anything. And please comment on all the articles and podcasts that go up as well, because I know I like it and my guests enjoy it as well. If you have any comments for them, any questions, any links, we want to get the conversation started, so whack that up as well. And thanks so much to the members. It's always great to have you on board and to help me continue here in Real Alternative Media from Sydney, Australia. So always great to be here. If you're out there in the world and you hear some of these shows and you enjoy them and you like the guests that I have on and you enjoy the content, you can log on to krazfiles.com as well and become a subscriber over there, and really helps me to continue. But you can find me on YouTube and those social media outlets as well, so just look for Kraz Files and check out the YouTube channel. That's going really well, and I'm putting some great shows up there for folks to have a listen to. Arno, you're back. My great guest Arno's been on with me now. This is the third time, the third show that we've done, and we're just continuing, really. We're just moving forward and continuing to break down everything around us and break down all this fear and guilt and everything, and move forward as best we can. So we always have great shows with you, man. Great to have you back on deck. I know the listeners out there really enjoy hearing all your great thoughts and research and everything that I just love how you put everything together, and you're a really great mind. It's always great to speak with you anyway. How are you today over there in the land of Africa? What's going on your end?
Yeah, glad to be back, Adam. Thank you. I'm doing better than ever. I always like to say that every single day that I'm alive, better than ever, better than ever, better than ever, better than ever.
You're feeling good. That's good.
Yeah, I'm just. I just want to keep that vibration going, as if everything is spiraling out, moving forward, and expanding.
Yeah,
and not looking back and not looking into time for the answer, just keeping myself busy in the moment, Adam. Time is speeding up, but I find that it speeds up together with us. It's us speeding up, and that makes us perceive that time is speeding up, and it's just feeling good to be alive here in Africa. As you know, everything is always alive and well here, as most of the people are still, you know, using their legs to move around all over the place. Transport is not such a big thing. So there's a lot of bicycles. You call these taxi bicycle drivers. These guys who lift people around on the bicycles through town. It's a very big industry. Yeah. You find hundreds of bicycle drivers that make money from cycling people around town. It's not much to pay these drivers. And of course, everyone walks to work and walks around. There's no such thing like everyone has their own car. So even when you go into the streets, you're likely to see more than 1,000 people just going into the streets, walking into a market. It's very lively. It's very bustling all the time. And sometimes the energy is a little bit contagious when you enter places like that, and That's what I enjoy about the freedom of moving around and experiencing all places, because when you witness different lifestyles and you start to find yourself in them, it doesn't take long to make a shift, even in your own life, just by really changing your location. And I was speaking with another friend of mine yesterday. We were talking about how traveling and education go hand in hand. The two go together. Mm. Education is a very large part of getting around and seeing the world and seeing what's going on in different places of the world. And as an individual, when you are allowed that opportunity, you do wake up to the illusion of the world that you were in previously. For example, in the first world, that which we call the first world is this modern world that we all imagine within Europe, within the USA, within Canada, within Russia, within China, and of course within Australia. This is known as your modern first world. Now, Adam, do you even know why they call a country a first world country, if I may ask?
Well, I would just assume that it's because you know, those countries are much further ahead, more advanced, and things like that. I mean, that's what most people would say, that they're more further ahead, they're more advanced, they're wealthier, they're cleaner, and all of this. They're places that many others around the world want to live in. And they're supposed to be, you know, these great economic hubs and where all the money's made. And it's just a better way of life if you're searching for that.
Yes, you also do find touches of the first world now also within the third world. That's the big divide that you find existing in a lot of these poor states in Africa as well as in South America. There's a very large divide between rich and poor.
You do. I get that traveling. Yeah, I've seen that in my travels. You do get that. You get poorer countries that are now. You have more of a, what would you say, like a burgeoning sort of working middle class that now have houses and cars and stuff like that, and they're moving quite quickly. And the divide, you know, the gap between the rich and the poor is getting more and more. And you see that in some of these countries, and you get a lot of technology coming in fast, and, you know, big screen TVs and people wanting this kind of lifestyle, this Western sort of lifestyle in a lot of these countries that were previously had a lot of troubles or were quite poor. But then you have a large portions of those populations that just can't keep up. And you still get a lot of crime and things like that, and a lot of problems in those countries. But I've seen it firsthand, yeah. Because in Australia, it's you don't sort of see that so much, you know. It's pretty fairly even. Everyone seems pretty happy and going along about their days. But then you go to some countries where there's a lot of gap between the wealthy and the poor, and you can really see it.
Yeah, it's. It's especially obvious around Cape Town, for example. Most of Cape Town is, you know, prime property worth in the millions of dollars, most of which are owned by foreigners who simply use them for holiday homes, maybe once a year, once every few years. So there's a lot of properties. I'm now speaking of Cape Town region, Southern Cape region, as well as Eastern Cape region in South Africa. Now, this is your coastal property market. And you probably know, Adam, even in Australia, how monopolized coastal property is, because you get something called prime property, which is something that is very monopolized in the property market. That being said, is the state usually owns property rights to coastal regions, and it's a funny thing if you go throughout Southern Africa, you know, Southern Cape, you find thousands upon thousands upon thousands of homes that are permanently vacant. Prime coastal properties all over the show. And when you go there, it's like a ghost town. It's like there's nobody there. And you ask yourself the question, what's going on here? And the sad answer is that when we talk about property, you know, the housing market, property housing market, that resembles a form of currency and ownership in its own right. So if you speak about following the money, it's also wise to see which individuals from which countries own properties where, because that would also be a form of an investment of a currency. Now, people invest currency in property, and so what happens, you end up with a lot of property everywhere, that's where there's nothing happening, people are not housed there. And when I'm talking prime property, Adam, it's really Southern Cape is one of the most beautiful ocean habitats you'll ever find. The whales are there every year. There's a lot of dolphins. There's a lot of penguins. There's a lot of seals.
It is beautiful, man. It's absolutely absolutely beautiful. That tip there and the tablelands behind, and they also have Jeffrey's Bay. Which is one of the most famous surf breaks in the world. They actually have huge surfing competitions there where all the world famous surfers go there and compete. And, you know, you've got all the nightclubs and all the bars and discos and very wealthy area. Yeah, it's a really different part of South Africa. It really is. You see that when I've never been there. I have a friend that went there. He said it was absolutely amazing. The beaches were just beautiful. The wildlife, the raw nature, and just it was so modern and everything's there that you could want, you know. It's amazing.
Yes, I remember you wanted to know a little bit more about
Well, that's where you grew up, isn't it?
Where I grew up, yeah.
Mm. So, is that where you grew up on near the coast in Cape Town, or?
I grew up in Durban.
Ah, right.
That's on the east coast.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
That's more up. It's more near the big mountains called the Drakensberg Mountains. There's a sovereign republic called Lesotho, and it forms the outskirts of these mountains, just 200 kilometers from Durban. And of course, we got the Indian Ocean that side. So on the Southern Cape, there's more of an Atlantic influence. The water's colder. So on that side, we got the hot water. And what a lot of people don't know about Durban is it's got the biggest population of Indians outside of India. It's got quite a big influence of Hinduism, and there are very large Indian communities. Still got their own freedom to practice their religion, which is good. They've got their own temples, and of course, South Africa is very much influenced by the Dutch and the English, of course. Both of which colonized South Africa in an arms race, really. So myself, I don't affiliate with any of these bygone cultures. You know, for a person to say that, oh, I am English, or oh, I am Dutch, is already affirming duality. You can't identify yourself belonging to a tribe, because when you do that, you automatically differentiate yourself from another human being who may genetically be different. And why are we using a class system that is identifying us as all genetically different? And where I come from, when you apply for a passport or for jobs or anything like that, that's still a large part of the biometric information under which I am classed. As to where I come from, who my forefathers are, and we see this happening in many parts of the world where minority groups are targeted just for their class of race or genetic adherence or belonging. And we should definitely, shy away from identifying ourselves from that, but rather not identify ourselves through that, because we are also controlled through that. It also serves duality, people allowing their biology to dictate the very law in which they exist. Now, Adam, in South Africa, everyone knows about the political situation there, and eyes have been on South Africa since the end of apartheid, where there was a time when race segregation was politically enforced. I wasn't around. Myself, being 4 years of age when apartheid ended. So, myself concerned, I grew up alongside Africans, Indians, you name it. I've went to school in my own mother tongue until the age of 13, which is Afrikaans. Afrikaans is basically comes from the Dutch, who needed to find a way to communicate together with Germans as well as the English, as well as the Africans, as well as to themselves, of course. So there was one unifying language really in South Africa, which was Afrikaans. Back in the day, everyone could speak it. Reason being, the entire so-called Boer republics, Dutch republics, were set up in the Orange Free State as well as the Transvaal. Now remember, the Dutch colonized the central areas, of South Africa, and the English colonized the coastal region in the beginning stages. The Dutch had their own sovereign republic. The Dutch who left Holland 500 years ago succeeded in establishing their own sovereign state, their own sovereign republic. Eventually, all the Africans who were also within those lands were also working for them and with them, because the great success of the Dutch were their farming. So their whole economic, their whole economy was built on farming. They farmed that whole country, thousands upon thousands of kilometers, and their success were tied to the windmill. Now, windmill technology is free energy technology. I've been telling this to people many times, how great and successful the Dutch were, only because of this technology, because they knew how to find water, and they knew how to get that water, and they knew how to pump that water into the irrigation systems simply by using wind. So their advantage was that they had the resources and the manufacturing prowess to bring that technology in and to pump water. And you see, they were very clever, because where did they start? We talked about it on the last show. They started with the water, and that's where you have to start. And during those days, Adam, when the settlers first arrived, you know, there were no engines yet, and people were literally going with oxes and wagons and horses into the wildest country you can imagine. Because before the white man arrived in South Africa, the Big Five were still running around that entire land, that entire Southern Africa. Rhinos, lions, everything was still running around. It was really could have been terrifying to sleep every night in a tent, knowing what's all around you. And then the next day, packing everything up on the wagon again, going through a landscape which doesn't even have roads. And it's a very tough landscape, of course. It's very hilly. It's very rocky. And I'm always astounded when I see what people were capable of long ago. It always astounds me.
Oh yeah, I mean, look at the look at Australia. You know, when the white man came here, I mean, what a harsh land. I mean, like, yep. You can see what happened in Tasmania when they brought prisoners here over from England. You know, this was the harshest place that you could ever possibly imagine. And you see this old footage, and you look at this old stuff where they're going in and they're getting the timber and they're just all hauling it, and the work they did, it's just it's unbelievable. They're very similar to the African lands, just wild, untamed animals, danger, and it's quite remarkable. It's an unbelievable thing. I think that looking at what I would always say, you were talking about the Dutch and how innovative they were and everything like that. It's one thing that's you have to see, isn't it? And we'll talk more about this in building cultures and cities and what's happened. But they do make incredible places and lands, don't they? They really, really do. They build incredible monuments, and they make incredible cities, and they make places where everybody wants to go to and everybody wants to live as well, like you were talking about with Cape Town. I wonder what would have been if there wasn't that the Dutch and others going in there and making that place. I wonder what it would be today, because they've made such an incredible place there, indeed. And that was really interesting what you were saying before, how the locals worked with them and for them to better that place and environment around them and make it what it is today. But continue. Do you see that? Yeah. Is there that connection still there today in places like Cape Town? Are they proud of what they have there, or is it? Have they kind of? How's it going? How is it working there?
Yeah. First, I have to say there wasn't necessarily always an integration, you know, of different cultures and tribes. There will always be and always will be those that prefer not to mix.
Of course,
with the larger.
Yeah, always.
Yeah,
you get that in the Amazon, don't you? Where those tribes just don't want to be touched or seen.
Yeah,
you know, they don't want anything to do with it. You know, it's really incredible to see that. You see, some of them have actually come out and met with the news and the cameras and told them, please stay away, you know, because they know that it's encroaching this modern civilization, and where they're going to run and hide, you know.
Yeah, they've got every right. You as a human being, if you have the right, if you prefer to want to have
leave me alone.
Yeah. no one is allowed to do anything about that. That's your freedom of right, as well as, you know, we also have freedom of speech, and we should have these freedoms, because if we don't, it works to create fear in us. Because if you feel, oh, I'm not allowed to say this, or I'm not allowed to say that.
Of course.
You get what I'm saying.
Was Arno, was your were your parents European or a mix? How was that? You identify, as you said, with your root, with your culture around you and your language and everything. But what was it with your parents there?
So I was born to Afrikaans parents. As I said, Afrikaans is still to this day the most known language in South Africa. My mother was born in Zimbabwe. At the time, her parents had moved from Holland to Zimbabwe. So her parents made a jump.
Was that for farming? Were they farming families?
Her father had some contract work doing something there. I don't think he was in farming. Jeez. He was more of a tradesman.
That's an incredible move, isn't it? From Holland to Zimbabwe. Gee.
Yeah.
Mm.
Those days Zimbabwe was even better than South Africa.
You're talking here about, because it confuses people, you'd be talking about before Mugabe?
Yes, no.
The older Mugabe.
You can say so. It was when the Britain was still governing the country through an interim government.
Ah, wow, what a beautiful country, man.
Zimbabwe also magnificent place.
Very special, huh? Yeah.
Very, very special place. Of course, you find Victoria Falls. All your wonders in Africa was also named after the Queen of England, of course, because the colonizer was usually an English missionary.
Mm. Yeah.
Tracking up all these countries and establishing churches. Churches were connected to the schools.
Mm.
So they were setting up education in teaching the kids English to all the missions. And that was the mission, to move around and convert everyone.
Mm.
So the big mission.
Yeah, and the vaccination programs.
Yeah, that came later.
We know all about that. Yeah, exactly. Churches and schools, yeah, education.
Zimbabwe, as was colonized by the English, the Dutch didn't have much to do there.
Mm.
The Dutch were only involved in South Africa. They attempted to gain their own sovereignty, but ended up losing to the English in a major war, which lasted, as far as I know, more than a few years. The English and the Dutch were at war over the Transvaal and the Free State Republic. I know a lot of stories of the concentration camps that Britain had set up in South Africa during that war, and how many Dutch, which we call now Afrikaners, were tortured, abused, and murdered, and starved to death in many of these concentration camps that were set up in South Africa. So South Africa had its fair share of war, mainly because of the gold and the diamonds which were found there by the Dutch. So when the Dutch first found these minerals, they first attempted to keep it a secret, but as soon as it came out, the Holy Crown wanted all her resources. And that's when there were a group of Dutch who did not want to, you know, identify with the Holy Crown anymore, and fought for their own sovereignty. It's a war that, of course, I know of very well, because it's part of my cultural history. And I'm just giving you my version, though I am not an expert on history. In South Africa, there were also a few wars between the Zulu. We've all heard of Shaka Zulu, a famous warrior king of the Zulu kingdom. Now, the Zulu kingdom is part of the eastern coast Durban area I told you about. It's a very tropical region, high rainfall. The Zulus were rooted there, although they did come from north. So what people also need to understand, if we're looking at what we call anthropology, or rather the science of human movement, where humans originate from, we can track where people come from. And in Africa, what we know clearly, looking at recent evidence of who was around during 500 years, 1,000 years, 2,000 years ago, it's quite ironic that the Khoisan Bushmen was the only people occupying southern Africa for thousands of years, mostly, before any Bantu tribes had moved in from central and eastern Africa. So we find that Africans also did colonize Africa itself, concentrating and expanding mostly from the same regions. In the political situation in South Africa, there's a lot of debate always going around about who was where, when, who's got the right to be on the land. And this has been used, this motive has been used as a motive to murder in a lot of crime across Zimbabwe as well as South Africa. There's a territorial issue related to spiritual heritage, and in some cases, land is a do or die scenario and situation. Because if you find yourself in an environment where you don't fit into any economy, the only viable thing you can really do is own a few animals and grow vegetables and survive, as they say. And that's why you find in Africa, the what people don't know is that in Africa, the property market is to a large degree monopolized by chiefs of tribes. So this allows all minority groups and those belonging to certain cultures to be able to have access to property for a very small amount. So it's like you bypass the legal property market that is based on certain guidelines and parameters pertaining to the price. So it's quite common to find a piece of property, lifelong lease for $50 a piece, $100 a piece. It's like they're rationing it off, you know? And they have a political right to do that. And this is how it works in all the villages, most of the villages in the countryside outside of the cities in Africa. It's important for people to know that, because the property market is a huge scam, the biggest scam man has ever seen. And it enslaves people to the banking debt system. And it's another crime against humanity, the insane prices humanity has to pay for simply occupying pieces of land.
Just on that, brother, it's really interesting. Just where I grew up in Australia, on the beaches near Sydney, my father bought our family there when. Before I was born, because he wanted he had a couple of boys already, and he wanted them to have a good life, because he came from a hard life, and and then he had me, and he brought us to these beaches areas where I grew up and I still am now. And to cut a long story short, we grew up on these beautiful beaches of Sydney, running around in the woods and running around on the sand on the beach, and we were all beach bums, And we used to go to my grandmother's house for Christmas. She had a huge house. I used to play up in the attic. I had another grandmother with another huge house. My parents had this old house. It was huge. We used to run around the bush and have fun, and we never thought about, we have views of the beach, we're near the water, this is worth money. It was just the home that you grew up in, and all your memories and dreams and childhood memories, as I said, were in that place, and nowadays, it's just absolutely ridiculous. I mean, it's $500,000 for a crappy one-bedroom apartment near the beaches. It's $2, $3, $4, $7 million for a house with water views. And I myself, and many others who grew up here, who were born, who have roots in this area, cannot afford to ever live or have a family and buy a house here, unless you just get a monumental mortgage for $2 or $3 million that you're never going to be able to pay back. And then I see all these people who don't even want to live here, who never grew up here, coming in and buying all these homes, tearing them down, putting up these monstrosities, and then reselling them. It's like this monopoly game, just buying and selling properties for them, like some kind of game. And I saw these people now who are paying all these millions of dollars just because they get a little view of the water. And it's amazing to me, because I grew up on the water and we never never looked at it like that. We always looked at it as a family home, and that's where the heart is, and that's where the family is, and that's where all your, as I said, your dreams and memories are. But now it's all being turned into this money game, and it really makes me sick. And so many people, and particularly I feel for young people who might be on the verge of getting married and wanting to start a family, there's no way that they can do that here. It's just, you can't afford it. It's absolutely insane. And we're getting that in many countries, in Western countries, as we talked about, around the world, around Sydney, and you know, you get like around London or New York or European countries, and as you said, in South Africa as well, where you've got the coastal areas, it's just absolutely phenomenal, the prices that you see now. And I think, is this going to burst? When is this going to stop? Because it just keeps going up and up and up to the point where it's absolutely ridiculous, you know, and everyone just wants that view of the water. It's amazing, but there's no heart and soul in it, Arno.
Yeah. I get what you're saying. People are completely diverted from that heart and soul of it. It's a mindset, and I call it an economic mindset. And it's quite prevalent in society how people think only in terms of money. If I meet someone on the street and I tell them I don't have a job, they will judge me immediately and think, there must be something wrong. There's something weird going on. Because people expect you to have a job. It's almost part of the collective unconscious mind. Everyone has to have a job. Everyone has to have a boss. Everyone needs to work. Everyone needs to make money. They call it reality. People like to say, oh yeah, it's reality. You have to get up in the morning, go to work, and come back in the evening and, you know, go to sleep. But the thing is, your lifestyle also really needs to change if you want to, you know, unhook yourself from dependencies involving debt. Because, you know, what I was saying earlier, this prohibition of movement going on is also prohibiting a lifestyle where people can work with each other and trade with each other. Now, people have mostly faith in larger markets, larger capital markets outside of their own circles. But Adam, if I gather six people and all seven of us farm something different through the year, and we put all that together, our survival might be very much enhanced in comparison than one person doing that. And that's what you call a cooperation. Now, capital markets are destroying true cooperation between people, because instead of people working together, people are competing with each other all the time. Competing. And guess what? Competition actually drives down prices of goods in most cases, because now you get an overflow in the market and all your agriculturists just make a small penny for what they need for a living. And this also ties into the exportation market, because what happens now, most of your farmers export internationally, because that's the only way they can get enough money, instead of keeping the goods in the countries locally and controlling the market in a way that they can still get by. But my big lesson for everyone is to move away from monocropping. Monocropping meaning farming with only one produce for a national market. It's not always the answer, and I see the entire third world is suffering because they are farming for an international market which is very competitive, and they can't make ends meet. And where I come from, governments are not really able to even support any farmers. In South Africa, all the farmers are supported by private establishments. Nobody supports the farmers in South Africa. If someone can prove me wrong, please, please do. And is that cooperation, Adam? Because you know, it's about time that we change our behaviors, and a lot of that has to do with breaking this global hold. Global, it almost sounds global hold. There's a global market, global trade system. They call it globalism. They call it the United Nations. There's this whole push towards the greater good for the greater number. But that is just a phrase word for democracy, greater good for the greater number. They call that democracy. So we end up living in a democratic world. Now, the world demo relates to a program, a repetition of acts that is repeated on a cyclical basis. It's a linear world. We all know if you do the same thing over and over for long enough, you end up crazy in the head. Because that's why they call it demo crazy, democracy, demo crazy. For you to run a demo over and over and over and over again, you end up crazy in the head for doing that. What I also need to say is that this is the world that is being forced onto everyone. Because as soon as you attempt to fit yourself into one of the constructs that they give you in capitalism, any role, any economic model needed for capitalism requires duties of services. Duties of services. It is duties of services that is liable to acquire debt. So that's how the whole thing starts. And once someone owes you for a duty of a service, you enter into a democracy. That is because that is democracy. Democracy is tied to capitalism. So you fit the purpose of the economic model, but you definitely don't fit your own purpose. This is what I'm saying, Adam, because you see, I'm really pushing on breaking this down this year. and I'm not stopping until until there's nothing left. You still there?
Of course. Yeah, no, it's very interesting. We got about I'll say this, we've got about 10 minutes left, but we were talking at the start of the podcast about we were going to talk about the human death experience tonight and fear, but that's a we're going to go into this on the next show. And there's some other things I wanted to ask you as well about isolation and all of this as well. So we'll keep that because that's very important, I think, fear and death and everything. So we're going to talk about that in the next show. But this has been very interesting. We got about 10 minutes left. Talk to us, Arno, a little bit about South Africa and the farming situation there and the white farmers, for example. We hear about all this persecution from the current sort of government and military and things like this. Explain this a little bit. Just give us the kind of bullet points about what's happening with that farming situation and those white farmers, because a lot of them seem to have been there for a long time and they want to be part of the country and part of the culture and feed people. And we are seeing, are we seeing this kind of persecution? What are you seeing on? What are you seeing there? You're from there, so there's no one better to get this information off, because it's confusing coming through the media, and we don't know what's what. But you know, you're seeing the newspapers showing a lot of persecution and beatings and things like that of these white farmers and pushing them off their lands. What's going on in South Africa, in modern South Africa, with that sort of situation and the farms and stuff?
All right. Well, I'm first going to speak from a now perspective, and I have to say I haven't heard of a farm murder in quite some time, which is good. I do usually receive news feeds from the political situation in South Africa, especially regarding to road closures. There's not a day that goes by where there is not a demonstration somewhere in South Africa where some major road is blocked by, you know, tires and rubbish and maybe sometimes trucks. Burning on the roads, rubble. People, there's a lot of cases where people are attempting to disrupt the entire, you know, system around them, because they are demanding municipal services. Now, this is an interesting topic. In South Africa, a lot of your smaller settlements have increased tremendously in the last 10 to 20 years. So this means that many areas that were before uninhabited have now suddenly become occupied through these you know, through an illegal property market. So a lot of your townships outside of the big cities really run their own you know, business. They're not too tied to officials and do deals under the table, as they say. For example, sometimes there are clashes between police and illegal settlers, where people are just staking out claims in natural areas before termed state land. Because remember, a lot of the state land is also unoccupied. So a lot of the time, the state would actually eventually give in and let new squatters settle. And of course, these guys initially, what a lot of them do, they will just build a small home, occupy for free, and then they'll start getting ideas and start selling the same home that they've illegally occupied and built up to other people. And so find an entire illegal property market springing up in the ghettos. And that's what's happening. And there's been clashes. Clashes are common sometimes, especially last year we had some clashes in Durban of new proprietors setting up homes on a hill. But now what happens, it has a chain reaction, Adam. So there's a chain reaction happening in the legal property market where people lose the value of their own homes due to settlements that have sprung up in the location, in the same location. So people don't want to buy those homes anymore because it's seen as a crime liable area, you know, because these people who are moving around like this and occupying everywhere. I believe most of them are foreigners. They are not from South Africa, so they are not able to really go anywhere. They are destitute. There are hundreds of thousands of people in South Africa working, open jobs, earning the bare minimum and living in a slum, literally put together by cardboard and a tin roof. There are thousands and upon thousands of people living like that, not having a toilet and living in close proximity to people all around you in stench. It seems to be a culture of the extreme of an extreme case of horrible living conditions. It's like a lot of people are living in the kennels, and it's fair to say that if you're living like a dog, your behavior will probably be the same, and then that's what we have as a materialization of crime, high prevalence of crime being breeded in these areas that are so compact and full of people who are simply there because of running an economic model in a democratic system which doesn't give them any profit ever. And I say that because living, as you said, is so expensive, you can't live. Even if you tie yourself into an economic model, you can't even live because what you make ends up going to your housing and your food and your electricity and your water. So you're now working to survive instead of living. Living to survive. So you see, there's a big problem with the youth. Everyone thinks the answers are in the university. They think if they go to university, they will come fine out on the other side and everything will be okay. Sorry to tell you, that's not the case. The world is chock and block, as we say, full. The competition market is full. This matrix has run its sell-by date. You can't fit any more people into all these limited, prescribed roles anymore. And it's a joke. It's a joke anyways that we're still running democracies and that individuals are running democracies. Because we have no faith in any global organization to sort things out, because at the end of the day, the only reason why humanity is treated like this is because of the threat of terrorism and national security. And the world is at a stage that is far enough evolved to take care of whoever is a threat to national security or whoever is doing harm to anyone. The capabilities, the militaries, the technologies, it's all there to actually take care of whoever wants to destroy mankind. And we wouldn't have to live in a world of competition and serving a ruler, or master rather. So Adam, I would just finally also just like to say that you've heard of the Adam gene before, looking at your name, Adam. What's that?
Yeah, go on, man.
Okay. I was speaking of the San Bushman, and it was to this day, it was only the San Bushman that exhibited the Adam gene. And DNA, which is to say that they closest to the original, what they call the original blueprint of the human being, and all the other races that you find today are deviations of hybridization from that original gene. So that's also the nice thing about traveling, because when you start making contact with people who still exhibit this in their bloodline, it can also be a major wake-up call. And that's what you find when you visit a lot of these tribal nations. I just wanted to fit that in there, seeing that we were also touching on South Africa and people there and where they come from. But as I was saying, it's really time that we take a very close look at how we live our lives and how we structure it, and what we use to define reality. Because, as we said, it's rather not a good idea to be defining it in terms of limits that you find in a prescribed language, which we're even speaking right now. So thank you, Adam. I really think we hit a few good spots this week around.
Yeah, thanks to for going through all that, and I think I've played that magnificent speech. I don't know if you've read through that. It was the end of living and the beginning of survival. It was in 1854 in the United States. The government made an offer for a large area of Indian land and promised reservations for the Indian people, and it was the response by Chief Seattle. His reply was one of the most beautiful and profound statements I think ever made in history on the environment, and it was all to do with how can you sell the sky and the warmth of the land, and that idea being strange to them, people can look that whole thing up, and how the Indian people saw everything right down to every shining pine needle and every grain of sand on the shore and the mist in the woods, every humming insect, as this deep, incredible experience for their people, even to the sap of the trees. And they just didn't understand how you could just buy something and sell it and all of this. And I think it's a really beautiful and incredibly deep thing. One of my favorite peoples ever, the Native American Indians, like that. And people called them savages. And you look at this speech from Chief Seattle, and it just absolutely blows your mind to pieces, you know, this absolutely incredible deep connection to the natural world around them. Was really phenomenal and something that people should look up and read, because you can take that to your you can take that right through your entire life and share it with everyone, and people just are blown away by it. So it's really a thing. But that was an incredible thing that kind of you just touched on there, the end of living and the beginning of survival. You know, way back in 1854, there you go. But it's sure. Remarkable. Yeah, it's just one of those things. It's something I know that people don't talk about much. Everyone's too sensitive now. We don't want to touch on things about different lands and different peoples and how things change and everything like that. You know, we're so sensitive now. No one really wants to talk about it. But I've definitely never done a podcast talking about Africa and what's going on there. There's definitely more to discuss, so there will be another podcast. I think we'll need to continue, because I'd love to talk about the current government in South Africa a little bit more, and what happened with Mugabe in Zimbabwe, how that changed and what he did and where he came from. And obviously he was funded. I'd love to know a little bit more about why that happened and the current situation over there, because we don't get to hear about that much. And as I said to you on one of the last shows, you get a lot of Africans confused and running and going into European countries and other countries where they're just like a fish out of water. And you're getting a lot of problems here. We're getting that in Australia, you know, and it's causing a lot of issues. And we want to sort of chat about that a bit. But it's a really interesting thing. I'm glad that you went over that. Before we plug out, is there anything you want to mention to folks out there in regards to what you're doing now? Contact details or anything?
Yeah, so if anyone wants to contact me, it's very easy. You can email me at deprogramthematrix@gmail.com. Also, Facebook page, Deprogram the Matrix, very easy to find. At the moment, you know, just focusing on these weekly podcasts, which I also have to say is keeping me going as well. It's something that I really look forward to, because there's a lot to share, and in Africa people don't know what's going on in Africa, you know, and we need time to talk about what's going on there. And then, yes, at the moment, I'm just involved in Malawi. I am working at introducing different crops, different vegetables to the local people. Reason being is that there is a big monocropping tradition here. So in Africa, people are very malnourished, and one of the main reasons for that is because people primarily eat corn, which we call maize, which is this white grinded maize meal. And Unfortunately, everyone is using the hybrid seats, so there is not much in that nutrition which forms the staple diet of Malawi. So I'm just working at starting new seed banks in various locations and seeing if the people are willing to farm new different kinds of crops. Also, the culture of harvesting once a year, that's also a big no-no. You want to be harvesting at various times of the year to keep your supply going. So there's a lot of things this side that people don't know, and it can definitely serve to aid them in some instances, because there is a an exchange of energy, the exchange being that you're able to enjoy the natural wild elements while you're out there, making a difference to people's lives, as well as moving around, because moving around is very liberating. We have to say that if you keep yourself in confined spaces too much, you start behaving like the dog who has never set foot out the gate before. Either you run a million hours per hour away from home and you never find it again, or you're too shy to even walk past the corner before you want to run back to the confined space. We're not cattle. Freedom of movement, move around, get new ideas, see new people. It can really work miracles in your life. So if anyone wants to get involved in volunteering in Malawi, you can also get a hold of me at malawiadventurecamping@gmail.com. So that's all the details I got for you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Adam, for providing this space, and I look forward to continue in this unfolding.
Absolutely. I think we're covering good ground and moving forward and keeping the same theme going and putting in there something different, because I'm in Australia and you're in Africa, so it's an interesting mix that we have here. And no worries, we will continue, and there's some subjects, as I said, that I want to cover myself, and we're going to do that. We've got lots of time to cover everything. There's just so much to go through, for sure, but we will do that indeed. And take care, man, and we will chat again the same time next week.
Thank you, Adam. Take care.
All right. See you later, buddy.
Cheers, buddy.